Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the RUT Podcast, where we explore the extraordinary stories, psychology, and deep intricacies of men's mental health. I'm your host, James Roycroft Davis, and I started this podcast after finding myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started to talk about how I felt. Our mission is very, very simple. We want to finally get men talking about their issues, talking about their problems, talking about their mental health. There's still way too much stigma around men's mental health, so we want to break down toxic masculinity, one podcast at a time. If we talk, we save lives. It's that simple. Please do remember to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on currently, and leave us a review too, or find us on social media and tag us in your posts and your comments and your feedbacks on episodes. It's so greatly received and we love to see it. So you can find us on social media at The RUT Pod for the latest updates on episodes. This month is Movember and The RUT Podcast will be growing a moustache to raise awareness for men's mental health and men's health as well. We'd be so grateful if you could spare any change to help us raise money for this wonderful, wonderful charity. We know that times are hard right now, but if you can help us raise some awareness for men's health and men's mental health by either donating to our Movember page, donating to Movember itself, if you don't want to donate directly to our page, or by growing a moustache, literally every little helps. Get people on the street interested and shout loud and proud about why you've grown a furry friend above your top lip this month. A link to our Movember page is in the show notes below. The price of a cup of coffee will literally go a massive, massive, massive way. So thank you for those who do donate. Thank you to those who are raising awareness already out there. To all the Mo Bros who are going to grow their moustaches this month to raise awareness for men's health. You're awesome, awesome, awesome people. It's such an important cause. This week on the podcast, I am really excited to welcome a fabulous, fabulous man, Nick Ead, TV presenter and pop culture expert, to The RUT. I'm lucky enough to call Nick a family friend, so this episode was actually really beautiful to sit down and record. He's known my mum for probably best part of 20 years now, and he's just an amazing, amazing human being. Since his teenage years, he struggled with his mental health. It kind of started when he started battling his mind over the way he felt he looked. His mum died in 1997 from a sudden stroke, tragically, and I think Nick freely admits he never properly dealt with the grief. However, Nick has had an amazing career in the world of celebrity, television, hosting daytime TV shows regularly, presenting on Sky One. He was head judge on Project Catwalk, and he's also regarded, whether this is a good title to have or not, I'm not sure, but he's also regarded as the Simon Cowell of fashion. Anyway, Nick's story is incredible. It deals with depression, anxiety, suicide ideation, which we talk about at length, the death of his mum, grief, and more. So, Nick, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Here's Nick's story. Please leave all judgment at the door. Nick, welcome to The RUT. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited about this.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Surviving lockdown.
I know. How did you find it?
I found it difficult, to be honest. At the beginning, I found it really, really hard. I'm a very rational person in some ways. So I was really trying to work it out.
Yeah.
And I was kept on feeling that I was in some very strange science fiction movie.
Yeah.
And then kind of realizing.
I imagine you still do.
I still do. And then trying to rationalize it. And then, you know, from a practical point of view, seeing potentially my business crumble. Yeah. And other people, you know, lots of my friends, you know, their whole livelihoods, you know, going. You're right there. Yeah. Going.
We've got a slight technical problem. Phone malfunction from the minute one, but all good now. Anyway,
carry on. Is that okay? Yeah. So I think the impact at that time, potentially for me, was it was just really hard to work it out.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when you want everybody was, you know, as everyone says that we're all in this. People say we're in the same boat. We're not. We're in the same sea, but we're in different boats. So, but I think what was very interesting was that it affected everybody.
And yes.
And, you know, from mental health through to just panic.
I know.
And through to friendships and relationships and diet and health. I mean, it really had an impact on everything. And something that I never actually, you couldn't, if you'd, you know, predicted that when everyone was going, yeah, 2020, it's my year, it's my decade. And then suddenly realizing that this is crumbling, you know, I think a month before I'd been at the Oscars in Hollywood, you know, dressed up, you know, having the most amazing time. I'd been at meetings with sort of Netflix and Amazon about some TV shows. I'd been to see agents. Like I was, 2020 was like the trajectory was planned. And then suddenly, you know, this big slate sort of slaps you in the face.
I know.
And you just go, okay, well, we've got to navigate this in a different way.
Mm. Thank you to my mum for introducing us, actually.
Yeah, I've known your mum for years.
20 years,
yeah, exactly.
That is such a long time.
It's a long time.
Almost exactly. As long as I've been
alive. I know, exactly. It's a bit scary. Exactly. But she's great. I love your mum.
I know. You've got... Oh, this is about to fall off.
Why is it falling off?
I don't know. We can cut this out though.
Just push it a bit further.
And after a slight technical malfunction, we're back in the game, I hope.
Yeah.
I never actually knew you suffered so badly. Because let's be honest, you have suffered really, really badly with a variety of different things, whether it be overall mental health, suicide ideation,
yeah,
binge eating disorders, mm-hmm. The life of being a celebrity and essentially being in public eye, mm-hmm. and being in demand all the time, mm-hmm. Confidence, imposter syndrome. Obviously, we'll get onto your podcast as well in a bit. But take me back to kind of where it all started. You're from Edinburgh,
yeah.
And by all intents and purposes, you had a very happy upbringing, right?
Yeah, my upbringing was great. You know, my father is a very famous scientist, a geneticist.
Mm-hmm.
And my mum had been a performer. And then, unfortunately, she had her vocal cords cut. So she had that kind of was always something that she held with her. That sort of, she should have been a big star, a performer, opera singer, musical star. And that never happened because of what happened to her throat. And I remember at school we used to, you know, I used to always get the parts in the plays, etc., and in the musicals and stuff. My mum used to be quite frustrated when I was singing because she wanted to sing those notes and couldn't. So I always used to see that. You see that pain in her. But actually, funny enough, going back to that school thing, I think the time where I realised that I was affected by stuff was actually through school. I was very affected by the fact that people who were in the first 15 in rugby or were prefects were given the best roles in the musicals and the plays, and I wanted to be an actor at the time, and I couldn't get through my head how just because of their academic or their sporting prowess that would allow them to kind of get better things than I could when I was the one who genuinely wanted to be an actor. And I used to really kind of depress me that I'd be like, well, so does that mean if I...
What was resentment?
It was resentment, not jealousy, because I've never been jealous, but it was resentment and anger because I was like, but I want to be the star, the lead, because I should be, because I'm the one that wants to do it. If he wants to be a scrum half and he's good at it, you'll give him the role, but why are you not giving me the role of being, you know, Mercutio in... Merchant of Venice or whatever.
I've done quite a lot actually, in terms of where this all began. It seemed like it was you got to about 18 and you're about to go off to university. You went to Leeds?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And the kind of, you noticed binge eating eating disorders were coming in. Had that been coming in through your late teens?
It had kind of been something that I had. I think although I hadn't really thought about sexuality,
yeah,
I think that potentially had been something which was bubbling under.
Oh, interesting.
So I think I was always an extrovert, but also kind of thrust front and centre and had a big, we talked before this about happiness. Mm. You know, luckily, God or whoever, I'm not believing God, but I was born happy. You know, I wake up happy. My natural disposition is happiness. Mm. So everything else that comes at me disappoints me. But you know what I mean? Like, I don't need things to make me happy. I'm the happy thing that other things need, to be honest. So that's an interesting disposition to have, and I've had it since day one. So I think that may have been an issue. And I found that food or my kind of use of it, I remember when I went to art college, went to Glasgow School of Art before I went to drama school, that's where I sort of began to kind of tinker with it. You know, I think when other people were probably taking drugs and tinkering with sex, I was kind of looking at food as a kind of a way of emotionally sort of fulfilling me.
And what was it about food? Because I've had a few people on now who've had varying degrees of binge eating disorders or disorder with food. What was it about food?
Well, I think food immediately gratifies you. You feel comforted by it.
Yeah.
So, and you immediately kind of feel that instead of talking like we do now, it's a way of kind of just almost having a bit of comfort. Mm. So I think, you know, I remember, like, obviously, what was interesting was when I went to art college, I was really talented at art and I loved it, but it wasn't something I really wanted to do. I just had to do it because to get to university, basically. And then I wanted to be at drama school. And when I went to Bretton Hall, which was amazing, it was like a fame school, it was fantastic. And everybody wanted to be an actor. And I came in as an artist and I never felt I fitted in. Mm. And so I punished myself through it. So instead of the feelings that I may have had when I was at art college of kind of love with affair of food, I used food at drama college as a total way of punishing myself, telling myself I wasn't good enough, telling myself I wouldn't get a part, telling myself that I wasn't a good enough actor, I wasn't good looking enough, it was just a very, very painful, interesting, and then I'd punish myself. I remember once I was walking, I mean, West Yorkshire in the middle of winter is pretty bleak.
Yeah.
And I remember I used to, our house was probably about 6 miles away from, or maybe longer, from the college campus. And I used to kind of punish myself by walking in whatever rain, wind, sleet, snow it would be, as a kind of way of,
wow,
kind of punishing myself. There was a lot of, underlying anger.
How old are you then?
Well, I'm 21.
Right, okay.
You know, 22.
Mm. You talk about your relationship with your mum, actually, in some of the stuff I've read and watched, and how she actually had a culture. I didn't know that she came from an acting or fame background as well, but like, she had the mainstay of yo-yo dieting culture,
and that
rubbed off on you. Like,
yeah, I think it did.
What was that?
Well, honestly, it was a seasonal diet.
Mm.
So we were brought up on hearty food and you know, during the winter.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and good Scottish fare and great dinner parties my mum would have because of my dad and stuff like that. But then, you know, by March, it'd be diet time. You know, my mum was dieting, so we would kind of be on that diet as well. So it was kind of that weird. So by the time we went to Brighton, where we had a house in the summer, we would be sort of not malnourished, don't worry.
No.
But we would be kind of, you know, eating far less than we ever would during the wintertime. So I kind of had this, and I saw that in her as well. I saw her depression with her weight.
Mm.
And I think in those days, maybe, you know, people of my mum's age wouldn't define that, you know. So I think that was interesting. And, you know, you touched on it, and I always do, that I had, you know, my mum, I was adopted, so I felt, you know, when they told us, me and my brother, we were pretty old, like, you know, I was, what, 16? That's a long time to be with a.
Did that
your
have
mom,
any psychological?
A massive effect. Of course it did. Yeah. You're looking at your mum and dad, and they're not.
Did you not?
I had
know
no
at
idea.
All.
And I looked very like my mum, and my brother looks like my dad. Like you wouldn't.
Really?
Yeah. It was interesting, but you. It. Yeah, of course. Because it. I mean,
what was running through your head at the time?
That you're not. You're not my mum. You're not my dad. But you're not my brother.
It's like the trust.
Like broken. This is gone. Like what the. Hell has gone on here.
You can swear.
Okay, good. Great. I love swearing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really hard because you're there going, shit, this isn't. And I lied. I did a lot of lying then. Mm. I lied to my friends at school. I was like, I'm an Indian because we'd been in India for a while. And I was like, I'm a prince from India. My mum and dad, my dad's a Maharaja. Not because I wanted to lie, but actually, in a weird way, I've been given permission to do anything because I've just been told. My mother, who sees me every day, is not my mother, and my father is my father. So actually, my mum and dad could be fucking anybody.
Yeah.
Because they really could.
It's fascinating.
So it's very fascinating.
Lying school is a really interesting one, actually, because, your lying manifested, I'm sure, it manifested in that way, but also, it sounds like you were emotionally self-harming anyway.
Yeah.
And therefore, the need for people to like you. My brother talks about it all the time, how he went through school as pretty much a pathological liar, right?
Oh, really? Okay.
Literally. And same being at home. Like, he would just lie about everything. And that was because he didn't love himself and he wanted other people to love him.
Yeah.
And it's like this adulation that we constantly, like, seek.
Yeah.
Even from a young age is built up over many early years.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, definitely. I think when you're younger, you know, they always say those kind of seeds are sown and they don't leave you really.
Mm. Food, we kind of touched upon how food made you feel, but then also you've written about being repulsed by you, your body.
Oh God, I've got such issues, like honestly, and I still, to this day, and it's an endless fight. It's a battle.
What is the battle?
The battle is, and this is why I get kind of angry about, you know, Instagram and stuff like that. That actually, this didn't start with Instagram. This is something that's happened for years. You know, it doesn't matter if you see someone with an 8-pack or someone with a big belly. To me, Instagram isn't the root of the evil. The evil is something that's deep rooted within yourself.
What do you think the root evil is for you?
I think it's I don't actually. I think it's. Is it acceptance? Is it? It's just being comfortable in your own skin.
Mm.
It's having the comfort. Having the. It's about being acknowledged. It's about being, as you've just said, touched on with regards to, you know, it's about doing well and being told you're doing well. And I suppose for me, I've always done really well, but I never feel I've had that pat on the back. And that's always been really, really tough, you know. And I think when I was younger, I didn't get it from my dad because he was a scientist. He was always away. My mum was quite stiff upper lip. So you never, although she loved me and my brother, you know, endlessly, it was quite stiff upper lip kind of style of loving. And I think maybe, I don't know, I think that's where it stems. And also, you know, my mum died when I was 23.
Yeah.
And that was, that impact is absolutely huge. You know, Princess Diana died the same day. The world was sad. Mm. You know, you're walking around and people are crying. And the world, the television you're watching is about death. And you yourself actually living through real life grief. Mm. It will fuck you up endlessly. And it will.
Let's go back to the kind of, your mum died of a stroke.
Yes.
So let's go back to that day. I mean, what happened? Obviously, most people have woken up to the news that Princess Diana has died in a car crash.
Well, actually,
you're waking up to the news
that my mum was dead.
Passed away from a stroke.
So it was, well, actually, what happened was I was at work and I get a call from my dad saying your mum's not too well. It's on the Friday.
And this is up in Scotland.
This is in London. Oh, I was in London.
Yeah.
Sorry, my father was in, where were they? They're in Brighton.
Okay.
So, and I'd seen my mum the week before. I was planning on coming down to see them anyway. And I was at work and my father was like, there's something, I used to work for a box office, and my dad was like, oh, I think your mum's not very well. Just don't panic, but we, you know, she's probably going to Charing Cross Hospital. So I was like, okay, okay. And then he was like, I don't know if that's going to happen. So then, obviously, you know, all this stuff goes through your head. And weirdly, I'd had my mobile phone stolen the day before, and so I wasn't contactable. I mean, this is the day of the, when they were bricks.
Of course, yeah.
And so it was all about that. It was just, I mean, it's all a bit of a blur. But anyway, I ended up going down to Brighton. My brother was living up in Skye. I mean, the furthest place you could ever think of from Brighton.
Yeah.
So his train journey is like 15 hours. Oh my God. There's no flights out there. Do you know what I mean? He had to take the whole thing. So he was coming down. And so we were waiting for him. And then I went to sleep. And then basically, all I heard was the Queen of Hearts is dead. This is, and my dad was listening to it on the radio. So I was in this kind of daze of crying and scared, not knowing my mum was alive or not, and then hearing this, the princess, the queen is dead. So my head was like, oh, princess, the queen, like, what is going on here? And then I see my dad, and I say, what's like going on? And my dad goes, my dad's crying. He's like, Princess Diana has died. Your mum will be so upset. We need to tell her. And then we get the call to say that, you know, your mum's dead. So it was like, oh, gosh. So it was just like, and then the work, like, everything, the world
How
grieved.
Does that even feel?
It's just the worst. Because you are in a muddy quagmire of grief, and everywhere you look, and I didn't know how to deal with grief. I didn't know how to deal with death. I hadn't experienced it. I'd experienced it with my grandmother, but you know, you kind of, you're a bit far away from them, a bit removed, so you don't have that huge impact, and I was too young really to kind of work it out. So this was my first ever experience of death.
But the worst kind of one to have, because
it's instant, it's sudden, there's no goodbyes.
Precisely, but also in terms of the relationship between you and your dad and you and your mum, actually it seemed like you were a bit closer to
my mum was my best friend. Right. Like, you know, I was that, my mum was my world. And my dad, you know, at the time, hadn't really taken time to really consider me. Or he did my brother, but not so much me. So my mum was my world. You know, I talked to my mum 5 times a day. You know, that was it. So, yeah.
When you just said that, sorry to pick out something you just said. You just said your dad didn't have time to consider you. What does that
mean? Yeah, what does that mean? I hate these when you're so analytical.
he it's didn't, my job.
Because he didn't. He, you know, he was a very different person. He was old, much older.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, you know, my, you know, he was much older than most dads were. He was very cerebral. He was, all he did was talk about and think about science.
Introverted.
Yeah. And, you know, I was just the fluffy one down in London. Although he was very, he loved my sense of humour and me.
Of course.
It just related in a different way. Mm. You know, I wouldn't call him every day, but I'd call my mum like every, you know, all the time. So, yeah.
And that will have an enormous impact on you anyway.
Of course it will.
Yeah.
Of course it will. So that, yeah, exactly. Even that one thing of being able to pick up a phone and call, speak to somebody, just tell them how you are, what you're doing.
It's also kind of this acceptance thing. If you feel like your dad doesn't accept you.
100%. You know, and I hadn't told her that maybe I was gay at the time. And,
right, okay.
You know, we hadn't talked about that. We hadn't talked about futures. We hadn't talked about loads of, you know, the important, well, not just the important stuff, but we hadn't talked about everything that we should have talked about. So it was, you know, kind of kept left in limbo. And, you know, from there, you know, I went back to work like 3 days later because I had no idea, like...
No. But nobody does.
No one does. There's no manual.
Everybody says take your time, but actually the last thing you want to do is sit at home and just grieve.
Yeah.
It's how do you grieve properly?
Yeah, and then what does grief look like?
What did grief look like to you?
Grief was difficult. Grief was a very, very... I mean, I would say I still grieve my mum's death now. Mm. Grief for me was painful. It was suicidal thoughts constantly. It was asking questions constantly, why me, not getting it through my head how this could happen, not understanding how I could progress past it, not looking at people and just thinking they're all dicks, because they, you know, I was getting phone calls from stuff and work, and I just was looking at priority and thinking this means nothing.
Yeah,
when I'm going through this, like, just, yeah, it was very, it still is. I would say every single day I think about it. Mm. Every single day I have a pang of grief. Because with my dad, it was natural. My dad was 93. He passed away 2 years ago. And with him, you know, you see that deterioration and you see the kind of a progression which you kind of should see with old age.
But you also accept.
And you accept it. Mm. And I grieved for him probably 2 years before he actually passed away because I knew, and we both knew, that it would happen. It was imminent. It's life. Whereas when it's early and it's cut short, you're never gonna be able to work it out.
Mm. How has grief changed since those moments where grieving for you was suicidal thoughts, and it was obviously you've just lost your mum. This is genuinely the worst thing ever. To now actually
accepting it.
Yeah. What's that process been like?
It's been a battle. It still is a battle. Like, as I said, we talk about food and we talk about acceptance. There's never a day that doesn't go by when I don't have either a suicidal thought or a hatred for myself or a fear for the future, which I naturally bat away like I am a tennis ball. And I'm just naturally like that. You know, I've never had therapy. I've never had any, I mean, I've been in situations, you know, but I've never had like a therapist.
Why?
Why? Because I see that as failure. I know you.
Interesting, yeah.
I see it as failure.
Mm. I swear by it.
I know, it's funny, isn't it?
Did you have one yesterday?
Yeah. You see, I'm like, fuck you, I don't want to tell you anything. Mm. I prefer this, to be honest. Mm. Although then I think shit. Then I think everyone's going to judge me, and oh my god, what if somebody thinks that this is like, you know, I'm unreliable.
Do you know what? That's funny you say that. I'll come on to imposter syndrome and depression.
Yeah.
But the 25 people had on the podcast so far. Well, 17 in season one, and since what we've recorded, have all had this similar nervousness to open up.
Mm.
But actually, the outpouring of love is extraordinary. It's one of the things that I love about this podcast is people listen and they're like, oh my God,
yeah,
fucking hell, Nick, or Tom, or whoever it is, this is amazing. Thank you for doing this.
Mm.
It's just therapy isn't for everybody. I accept that. But everybody should have a therapist or try therapy.
Yeah. Mm. We'll see. I think that I'm lucky. I've got a really good, strong friendship group.
Yeah, yeah.
And I see them. And a great. My husband's amazing. Although, to be honest, you know, I talk to him. I won't tell him. I mean, if he listened to this, he'll learn a lot more. You know.
Why didn't you open up?
Why don't I open up about it? Because I see. You know, this inherent thing of failure and
hesitance. And hesitance
about being vulnerable. And you know. And, you know, my husband is a fantastically loving, giving, caring human being. And I think it would really affect him to hear that, you know, still, you know, you have these thoughts and these, you know, these feelings. Mm. So that's why.
But they're natural.
Of course they're natural.
Yeah, and suicide ideation, I talk about it a lot on the podcast because I've been through that myself and still do go through it, actually, is... they're fascinating because actually they're just thoughts.
So I mean, you know, you've
and
just
you got, had Owen Cain.
Yeah,
Owen Cain,
he talked about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've just
what did he say?
Well, no, I just want to say that this is the simple thing. I mean, I don't know even why I'm telling you this, but I am. Is that I've just gone to make myself chicken for tonight for me and my husband, and I was opening up. I got the chicken, opened it up. Put in the thyme and a clove of garlic. Made it all lovely. So get ready. And I looked at the knife and my first thought was, if I was to do this now, should I cut my wrist or should I stab myself, cut my throat, or should I just cut the chicken?
Mm.
And so I went, I'll cut the chicken.
That's fascinating.
And I'm like...
But that's normalised, right?
It's normalised. It's normalised. Yeah. 3 days ago, I was in the bath and I was like, ooh, if I just slipped here, I would hit my head... And I'd drown. Andy wouldn't know anything about it. And then everything would be fine.
Mm.
And it's normalised. Mm. And you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
How can that be normalised? And then you snap out of it. And then you go, okay, Nick, that's ridiculous. But then it's
but the fantastic thing is you've conditioned and trained almost your brain now,
yeah,
your mind to have these thoughts and accept them as thoughts,
uh-huh,
and that's kind of the role of a therapist.
Yeah, and that's what Owen. Yeah, and that's what funny enough, what Owen sort of says. You have, you know, you do, and you're right. A therapist does that, kind of normalizes it, as you say, and kind of goes, well, that's not just the way of your brain manifesting itself into a particular. But it's very in. It's very.
Do you find it intense or not?
I find it scary, but then I find it. I can just. I'm just deal with it. I've dealt with it for so long. Honestly, I've dealt with it for years. So I kind of. It's just like another thing. It's
so fascinating.
Yeah, it's like opening up an app on a phone and then you just close it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And go on to something else.
But twice or three times a day.
Yeah.
So interesting. Let's talk about depression, because that, I mean, for you, your mum dying was the end of your world.
Yeah.
As it is most people.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly know if my mum died today.
Yeah.
Touch wood. It'd be the end of my world. That has seriously impacted you and still impacts you.
Yeah, it does. I mean, listen, I think in those days when it happened, you actually, it's 23 years ago now. So you actually, depression wasn't really diagnosed as it is today.
No.
So there isn't, first of all, there isn't things like this, which are absolutely brilliant, where you can listen to people talk about it and normalize it. But also it wasn't actually even seen as a thing. You know what I mean? So it was, it was very American in the, are they depressed? Give them some Xanax. So I kind of like channeled it to do good things. So obviously I went into charity. I did all my stroke association stuff and, you know, I did that, you know, and I've been in relationships with people who are depressed. And when I look at their depression and the way that they have, it's manifested, whether it's through drugs or alcohol or sex, you know,
The big elephant ultimately is suicide.
Is obviously terrible and impactful. And obviously, you know, that shows somebody has no end to it. But as, you know, I said at the top of this, you know, I was born, my natural reset is very optimistic and very happy, you know, and so I see that as a really strong trait to have, and it's really kept me going. And I'd never let, you know, I posted a couple of, a thing, I've had this issue with my ear, and I posted something on my Instagram a few weeks ago talking about how I've dealt with it for the last few years, and it's really got me depressed, like a depression that I hadn't ever really felt before.
Really?
Because it was a very different kind of depression, because it was beginning to dull my personality, and also I was beginning to be forgetful and not remember things, and I wasn't as articulate as I wanted to be. So it was, and it was eating up inside with me. So I shared it on my social media, and like we've just talked about, this whole thing is that actually I did it and I got some amazing outpouring and it was fantastic. And then I looked at it and I thought, oh, maybe this isn't right. So I archived it. And then about a day later, I thought, no, Nick, this is you. This is you, and you've done this for a reason. So put it back into the grid.
You archived it, really?
Yeah, I archived it because I felt ashamed. I felt really embarrassed. And then I thought, do I need to even put this up here? Because you look at lots of things on Instagram and social media, especially Instagram though, and that you're like, some of it you've got to sort of navigate through, because some of it you're just like, mate, get a fucking grip. And I was like, so it's hard to, I don't know, the narrative that it creates is sometimes absolutely amazing and really beneficial and helps lots of people. But then other ones are just ridiculous, and it kind of embarrasses me that I'm even part of that conversation, because it's embarrassing what they're saying, and using the platform as a way of kind of almost sympathy.
In that moment, because essentially you are kind of, so interesting, like you feeling ashamed, embarrassed, having to archive it. I mean, it's emotional self-harm at its highest.
I know, isn't it? You can archive your own emotion, well, your own something that I had thought about for a long time to actually post it,
yeah,
and wanted to articulate properly. Mm. To
what about it ashamed you and
vulnerability,
right?
Vulnerability, and I think
is it what do these people think of me?
What do these people think of me? And if somebody wants me for something,
yeah,
or
go
if
on.
They want me to be, I don't know, do be a spokesperson for X, what if they see that? Can they see past it? Which is ridiculous. You know, I'm in mid-40s. Fuck that.
Mm.
I'm a great person. If you want me, yeah, you want me. If you don't, you don't.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
But in that moment.
But in that moment, it was like the power of insecurity and power of... Yeah, it was interesting. Mm.
When did you come out as gay?
I came out as gay when I was 20... How old was I? 24?
Okay.
So
your mum died when you were
23? My mum died at 23.
Right, okay. And what stimulated me. You to...
Well, I was seeing... I saw boys when I was like in my at university.
Right, okay.
But I hadn't really had...
So
I
you'd
had,
known for a while.
I'd known, but I got... I had a girlfriend. I had sort of girlfriends and boyfriends and kind of like playing the field. And I was kind of like, you know, having fun. But I hadn't really identified yet who I was. So mm-hmm. I kind of didn't feel... My mum was kind of in a really weird way... She wasn't homophobic because she was the campest, most. She looked like Elizabeth Taylor. Smoked like a fucking chimney and was really ultra glam. She sounded like Elizabeth Taylor and was fab. You know, she was the gayest woman you could ever. You know,
right,
she was the
yeah.
archetypal gay icon. But weirdly, I think she was also kind of like. I think she didn't want me to be bullied, and they knew, but they never talked about it really.
With the stigma and
the stigma that, and all of that kind of stuff. Yes. But you know, I told my dad when I met somebody, he didn't, you know, obviously I was so nervous, but he didn't mind. He's a scientist. He knew nurture over nature. He knew, you know, he knew I was gay, you know, so that was fine. And actually his reaction was so underwhelming. It was like, oh, great, thanks.
Really?
And my anxiety like to sort of tell him was...
How did it eat away at you? Because
what?
Most people I've spoken to... two people for the podcast now who have come out as gay, and both of them obviously said, well, one of them didn't, but one of them was like, it's really eating me, it ate me alive.
Okay, so it never did for me.
Really?
It didn't, it wasn't even an issue with me. And the fact is, you know, and I have an issue with a lot of stuff to do with gay people and the way that gay people sort of explain their coming out, etc. Because I didn't experience it, and maybe because, again, my mum had died, so I kind of knew what shit was. So coming out as gay is nothing.
Nice.
But I think it first of all, it shouldn't be a big issue, as we know. Secondly, you know, I've never been to a pride march. I've never done anything like that. I look at being gay as who you love. It's who you wake up with in the morning. It's always been like that. It's never been from a political point of view. Which people might chastise me for, they might not, but you know, it's my opinion.
Yep.
And I've never used it in a particular way to I've never politicized it. Mm. I think it's terrible that there are places and countries that don't see it as or legalize it. And I think the way that people are treated in places like Chechnya, it's absolutely barbaric. And I think religion's got a lot to do with it, but that's another podcast for us. But I've always been very much about just, you know, you're gay, that's it, get on with it, who I love. And it's never been an issue. And it's never, ever been something that rules me. You know, a lot of people identify themselves as homosexuals, and that is their role.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not my role. My role is Nikied, and I happen to love a man.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Fascinating. Imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
You have a podcast... which everybody should listen to.
Thank you.
In pod... St-
it does
in podster.
Syndrome.
Slight mouthful. Yes. Why did you want to record that? You've had a very, very interesting, I suppose, checkered history with imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
God, fuck me, there's so many people that identify as having that. I probably think almost everybody does.
Yeah.
Why did you start it?
Well, to be honest, I was going to do one about adoption called Podoption, and I wanted to, because I thought, you know, it's interesting to talk to people about who've been adopted, because if you have a look, a lot of adopted people are massively high achievers, and they have been everywhere from Abraham Lincoln through to Neil Armstrong, you know, some amazing people who are adopted have.
I had absolutely no idea. Abraham Lincoln. Oh, yeah. Neil Armstrong was adopted.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason that a lot of people talk about the successes of people is because of their kind of imposter syndrome, because they have had to kind of identify themselves or create their own identity, etc. But they always feel that they don't belong somewhere, so they've always had to achieve more and more. And so that kind of then made me think, actually, imposter syndrome is really what we're all feeling, whether it's in different situations, whether you are, you know, the President of the United States, I'm sure he doesn't at the moment have it, but others will, through to, you know, they always say that one of the biggest ones is when you've talked to somebody who's been an airline pilot. You know, they've got a Boeing 747 or an A380, whatever it's called, and they are having all those people's lives in their hands. You know, the imposter syndrome that they feel is immense. Mm. Through to talent, you know, if you're Lady Gaga, she talks about it all the time. And, you know, then all the people that I've spoken to, it's so interesting to see how it rears its ugly head or how it drives you. Because there's the other thing, it actually does drive you and drives your career and where you want to go.
Well, you know, you'd obviously always wanted to be in TV, theatre, film.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I've...
Yeah. Performing, essentially.
Performing, yeah. You know, and I've always known... Listen, I knew from an early age that you're never going to... There's a top 3% who are going to be superstars.
Yeah.
And you can always, you know, want to be that, aspire to be that. But I've always wanted to communicate, but it's just... But I've always known that you've got to earn money as well.
Yeah.
Because going on Lorraine Kelly's show and getting paid 250 quid a week doesn't pay for anything. And although you get a public...
Is that what the appearance is?
Yeah, you know, you're on shows and, you know, you do Good Morning America and you're paid $100 and then you get a tax and you've got to get a suit. And you suddenly realise, actually, that you can't live like that. So unless you have a really big role... You know, as a presenter, or you know, you've got to think about other things. And I think, you know, having a business like I do, etc., allowed me to do both and become an expert. And you know, luckily, it's been a good few years.
Your career in TV started It's funny, actually, how many stories you hear of careers in TV starting like this. But you're at Shine TV, right?
Yeah, Shine.
And then as a runner, and then the presenter pulled out at the last minute.
Yeah, so I've been it was Russell Grant's show, who's the astrologer.
Yeah.
And they had got various different presenters who were going to be sort of his sort of Russell squad, and they were looking for somebody to be starstruck, his sort of sidekick. And they basically said, "Does anyone do it?" And I was like, "I'll do it." And they're like, "Okay, you're the guy that brings the Diet Cokes to the TV, you know, to the presenters." And I was like, no, I'll do it. And I was old at that, you know, old. I was 30. You know, that's to make a career change, to become a runner after you're earning a shitload of money at lastminute.com and, you know, American Express and big businesses. But I made that decision because I wanted to have a voice and I felt I didn't have a voice in those places. So I thought, right, I need to become a broadcaster. How do I do it? So I believe in making your own opportunity. Only you can really drive yourself. Only you can actually get to where you want to be. Other people can help you and they can open those channels, but only you're the one. And I proved that. You know, I was working as a runner, and then the next, you know, 2 months later, I'm on live television every day for a year.
How was that first show?
First show.
Shitting yourself?
Actually,
or did you have this sense of I belong
here? I had a sense of I belong here. I was shitting myself because I mean, nobody knew what they were doing. It was hilarious. Yeah. But I was shitting myself because I was like, I was pinching myself. I've done what I wanted to do. Mm. I was like, there you go, that tick box. But that tick box for me lasted, that euphoria lasted for, you know, a few weeks because I wanted the next.
Mm. What was the next? Sky One?
Yeah, you know, Project Catwalk and, you know, these, you know, Good Morning Britain and GM, Lorraine Kelly. Like, they're amazing opportunities. And I...
With Project Runway, you were head designer.
Head judge.
Head judge, sorry. And you've asked yourself... Which is where imposter syndrome essentially kicks in. Why the fuck did I get this job? Yeah.
I went in.
What's going through your mind in that moment where you're on TV and this is the tick box is done? You're clearly good enough.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you would not be.
Oh, exactly. You've gone through enough people.
You would
people.
Not be head judge.
Yeah.
On Project One, right? You've gone through. You've climbed the ladder.
Yeah.
Right. You've given up the great jobs that you said. Yeah. You know that going to American Express and
lastminute.com.
Lastminute.com. What were you doing there?
I set up the entertainment department. Wow. The group of us. It was amazing.
See, clearly good enough.
Yeah.
And then head designer, head judge at Project One Runway. What's that?
Catwalk.
Sky One.
Sky One. Sky One. Primetime show.
Primetime show. And then you're like, why the fuck am I doing this?
Yeah.
Like, what goes through your mind?
Just confidence and knowing, like, honestly, I mean, first of all, this is a great example of, I went in to Shine, who I'd obviously worked for, who were making the show. I went in to offer my services to put on their wrap party. That's all I went in for. And the producers were there and I was like, did this whole thing. And they were like, would you like to come back? And I was like, okay, I'll come back. And then I was like, I've got these great ideas. We're going to do this big catwalk. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to have big cake, canapes, you know, the whole thing. And then they're like, okay, so what would you say if somebody walked in wearing this? And they bought in a model wearing a really shitty piece of clothing. And I was like, well, first of all, I'd tell them they need to get some better glasses because that ain't a look that you want to see anywhere. And, you know, made them laugh. And then, honestly, like 2 weeks later, I get this call saying, would you be the new judge on Project Catwalk? And I was like, what? Mm. This is fucked up. Like, how? What? And weirdly, I hadn't got my mum to call to say, well done.
God, yeah.
Got my dad, who didn't watch television, nothing. Got my brother, who's into agriculture, didn't care. Got my friends, who I love, but kind of potentially didn't really get. I think my friends always think that I'm a doer. So nothing to them, no achievement I've made phases them. So they're like, they wouldn't say thank you, well done. And I hadn't got a partner and I lived on my own. So I was kind of like stuck. So I really was in this position where I'd
probably who hasn't developed this, like they call it internal versus external locum of validation. It's like, where do you get your self-love from, essentially? Like, for me and you, it's, I'm very much external. Like, I need somebody to pat me on the back.
Oh, God, me too.
For me to be like, even register I've done something even quite good.
Yeah.
And that's such a problem, because when you don't get it, it sounds like that's what happened to you. When you sat in your flat on your own, you're like, I'm just not good enough.
Yeah, you're like, well, woo, party for one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's because I was out of my punk comfort zone and I was given an opportunity that millions of people would love to have had, and I still felt like I shouldn't be that million. You know, I was looking over my shoulder for someone to go April Fool, you know, and that didn't happen, which is amazing.
But the funny thing is, you talk earlier about how it drives some people, like the top 3%. It can have a very funny effect where it'll either make you or break you. I mean, in all intents and purposes, it made you.
Yes. Yeah, it made me, and it helped my business, and it made me as a person. But, you know, my mum used to say to me, the happiest people are also the saddest people. And the reason being is that you feel emotion. You feel, you know, those highs and you feel those lows. So, you know, as soon as a show, you know, you walk into a huge big fuck off soundstage and you've got a seat there with your name on it and a star in the dressing room, and you've got your hair and makeup being done, and every ad break they're doing your makeup and hair. And then you go home to yourself and you are kind of like, how was your day today? Oh, all right. I did this, but you've got no one to share it with.
But has that changed now? You've got Andy, who your husband, like,
yeah, it's
has that changed now, or because are you still, because again, it's emotional.
Has it changed? I don't think it has.
Right.
He'd kill me for that because he's amazing. He's the most supportive person in the world. And I love him.
Same,
I love him more than anything. And he's the gift. He's just the best gift. But I think it's just, you just do it. It's so weird. I don't know. It's just weird. I can't really articulate.
Do you think there's any way to change it?
I don't know. I think there's a way of changing it. I think it's hard. I think, listen, most people in their lives don't, we're constantly auditioning. You know, if you're in the public eye, you're constantly auditioning. If you are doing PR that we do, you're constantly pitching, and it's all about auditioning. It's front and center. It's about what you're. It's like pitching, isn't it? Nonstop. And you know, there's an art to it, but it's also fucking tiring. And as you get older, you know, you've got less energy to do so, but you want more and you want to do more and to be bigger. So there's always going to be that kind of weird kind of dichotomy there. And I think that happens a lot.
How long do you think you suffer from depression for?
I don't think it was... I suffered from depression as soon as my mum died, very badly. And I think I kind of snapped out of it, though, to be honest, because I was... as I said, I'm my own therapist. So I kind of was like, well, okay, you need to do this and this and this. Like, I listen to people, and I know people, as we said before, who've had depression or got depression or, you know... And it's a very, very dark place to be.
Well, you say that. Okay. This is something you've written about in the Daily Mail.
Yes.
This actually... Oh, God. I broke the fucking microphone again. This actually sounds like, you reflecting back on depression. So let me just read it to you, and I want to get your thoughts. Alone at home, I'd sit in the dark. Instead of reflecting on my successes... I'd tell myself I was a failure, and my punishment would be to deny myself food. I suffered dreadful headaches and felt below par all the time. On the occasions when I did allow myself to eat, I would stuff myself with second and third helpings. Naturally, I was on my own. My confidence and self-esteem were so low, I was in no position to form a close relationship with anybody. How, when you hear that...
Do you know what?
That sounds really difficult.
When I hear it, I remember it.
Really?
Oh, I remember it very well. Mm-hmm. I remember it. I've recently felt it a bit, but I remember the worst part of it was, to be honest, I took the lights out of my bathroom. I took them out, so even when I switched the light on, I couldn't see myself. Like, it was that bad, and it was insanely bad. I have it here, I'll be honest with you, since lockdown, it's reared its ugly head, and I luckily nipped it in the bud.
What triggered it?
I think lockdown.
Right, okay.
I think lockdown triggered it, and I've got a mirror, like everybody else does in their bathroom, and I don't look at myself in it, and I will refuse to even catch my own reflection in it, apart from potentially shaving. But apart from that, I will not look at my body, will not look at anything, won't even examine a mole, let's say.
How does it manifest in your relationships?
I don't talk about it. I mean, you know, if Andy heard it now, I think he'd be quite shocked. So, you know, if he does hear it, then there we know. But it doesn't change anything. But it's interesting. It's interesting that. The thing is that I'm very self-aware.
Yeah.
So I can identify it.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, I get it. You're low today. Or I get it. You don't want to look at yourself.
Okay, this is really interesting. Because this is kind of like, how do you cope? How do you manage? Like, what do you do when you're in those positions of like, oh my God, okay, I can feel myself slipping into a rut. Like, what do you do? How do you manage it?
I quickly identify it and I quickly navigate my way out of it, because I know that if I was, as you say, stuck in it, then, you know, it would be quite mentally and physically impactful if I had got into it. So I'm like, I'm not even going to let myself go in there.
But that's that in itself is incredible resilience. I struggle to... I have to expend a huge amount of emotional energy not to let myself go into... I can feel it coming on. I'm like, oh my Lord.
Yeah.
Here we go.
No, I won't let myself even get there. I won't even...
Yeah, but how?
How? Because maybe I've conditioned myself to be able to do it. I just kind of just... As I said, right at the top of this, I'm happy. So I go to that place.
Okay.
You know, I go to the euphoric Nick. You know, I love love. I love people. I love everything I look at. I love everything I watch.
So to take yourself there, I mean, is it in your, are you imagining it in your mind, or are you like, right, okay, I need to get out and see my friends, or let's go for a dinner with Andy? Or...
I'll be like, okay, I need to stimulate myself differently, either whether it's watching TV or whether it's listening to a track of music, or whether it's writing, or whether it's daydreaming, you know, or just existing and, you know, come up with ideas.
Would you change anything?
I would change the confidence thing. I remember I used to have a friend, she's not my friend anymore, but we used to go out all the time, and I used to say to her, you look great. And even if she didn't look great, I'd still say it because I think it's important to compliment someone, although I also believe in truth. And she would say, I know. And she'd never say back, you look great too.
Yeah.
And it chipped away at me for years.
Yeah.
So it got to a stage where it actually got painful to be around that person because they never even... And I'd almost overcompensate. So I would... But I admired her confidence because she could go out looking like shit and think that she looked fucking brilliant, and she'd pick up the hottest guys, and I'd be like, wow, you're amazing. So in some ways, I'm a bit like, I wish I could be that confident. And everybody's fashion sense and the way they look is up to them. So, you know, but I think that confidence, there are so many people out there who are mediocre, but just have shitloads of confidence.
Yeah.
And
well, it could be perceived confidence.
Though. Perceived confidence. Mm. Yeah, but there are people who are confident.
There are people that are.
There are people who are confident and people who are mediocre and have done extremely well.
I want to talk about, you've been at the forefront of celebrity culture now.
Yeah. Too long,
yeah.
Yeah, decades. My God, decades. How can we say that shit?
Yeah. How has celebrity culture changed with the rise of social media, television, reality television, especially with mental health?
Well, I think, you know, listen, first of all, funny enough, I'm working on a really fun television project all about popular culture, which you're going to love.
Yeah.
And I've been working on it a lot for a couple of years. So I've been doing lots of research and writing with my producer in Los Angeles. And we've been looking at how really, you know, propaganda and social media and PR and advertising and celebrity has not ever really changed since, you know, dawn of time. You know, Jesus in many ways was the first kind of influencer.
Yeah.
You know, he had his group, he had his squad.
Yes,
you know, he was always, you know, if he can walk on water, he's, you know, is he the new Kanye? You know, is Kanye the same as him? You know, David Blaine, you know, same thing.
Absolutely.
You know, and they have followers, and it's very like social media. You know, you know, Jesus has got the biggest following in the world. So actually, has it really changed?
No.
Probably hasn't. You know, if you look at hieroglyphics, they're just emojis. They're just a way of, you know, emphasizing and educating. So I've been working on this project, and it's fascinating to really look at these things from perception of beauty. So, you know, people like Cleopatra, you know, who are perceived to be the world's most beautiful woman, bathing in ass's milk, you know, she's a minger. She's pretty ugly. She had black teeth. She was quite smelly, but she created a whole sort of aroma persona around her that made people think that she was the number one superstar in beauty, like social media does with Kim Kardashian, or like it does with Katy Perry or Kylie Jenner or Taylor Swift or Lady Gaga. So, you know,
mentioned all women there, actually.
Women, but men are just as interesting. You know, people like Julius Caesar and obviously Jesus. Jesus.
Okay.
You know, this is somebody who, you know, was a, you know, as we said, created a myth. A myth was built around him. He had one of his friends basically kind of like did the dirty on him.
Yeah.
And that happens, you know, when you're on social media.
Yeah, it's like Rebecca Vardy and Cody.
Rebecca Vardy and Colleen Rooney. You know, it's like a footballer saying something about somebody else. You know, this happens all the time. So, you know, looking at reality TV, really reality TVs are constructs of Greek tragedies. You've got a chorus of girls, you've got the guys, you've got, you know, you might not have the murders or the people thrown to the lions, but they are thrown to the lions.
They are, yeah.
So, you know, I find celebrity fascinating. I find, you know, especially things like Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, this kind of royalty becoming Hollywood royalty, yeah. and this very interesting marriage that it's become, which I don't think we've ever really seen before. We've seen it maybe with Wallace and Edward, but this is to a different extent. Very interesting. I think the culture of social media and instant celebrity is very powerful. I think that social media can be used for very great things, but also can be quite dangerous. Mm. I think the tragedies of people like Jade Goody should always be told to everybody that you can become the toast of the town and then you can have it ripped from your very soul.
Mm. I kind of see that in varying degrees in Katie Price, actually.
Oh, I do not know where that's going to go, but I don't see it going where we would like it to. It's going to end. I mean, where can it go? And it's an absolute shame. Mm. And that the drug, I mean, fame is a drug.
It is.
Fame is, and celebrity, you know, as they say, you know, if you ask kids now, what do you want to be? They want to be on Love Island. They want to be a celebrity. Mm. Well, what is a celebrity? And also, you know, for people who've been in the industry for a long time or who've had dipped in and out like myself, you know, you see people who have been on an island with their tops off, who are making more money than you've ever had, who are, you know, at a very young age, and who...
Where does it all go wrong for those people?
Well, it goes wrong because you have people like Mike from Love Island. You have people like Sophie from Love Island, you know. And then ultimately you have people like Caroline.
Yeah,
who, I wanted to talk about, you know, actually. People see, they see or they perceive that person to being a superstar.
Did you know Caroline?
I didn't know her. I knew of her. We've met a few times. We weren't friends.
No, yeah.
But, you know, we knew of the same people. Mm. And, you know, to see the impact that had on some very special people who I'm friends with is ultimately extremely sad. And you wonder with what happened a few weeks later with COVID and how the world was changed. Mm. You wonder what that narrative could have been like if she had carried on a few months later. You know what I mean? Like, it would have been quite interesting.
I'm not sure I do, actually. What do you mean?
Well, I think that, obviously, there's a trial. She was trialled by the media.
Yeah.
She was trialled by a jury, trialled by the police, and trialled by her friends. And I think what I'm saying is that lockdown hadn't happened before she passed away. Mm. So would have lockdown been a time for her to have helped her mental health, or would it have been just as tragic? You know what I mean? Like, but I think, you know, as they say with suicide, they don't, you know, if you want to go, you want to go. You know,
and we were talking actually earlier before this we started recording about your an ex-partner.
Yeah, my ex-partner, he passed away. He was, you know, he was a deeply troubled person, and, you know, he hung himself. And it was a real shame. He was so loved, so talented. He created. He was a stylist, but like a super stylist, you know, for some massive pop stars. But he had his demons. You know, he was addicted to drugs, and I think just, you know, it got to a stage. His friends were people. He was friends with people like Alexander McQueen, you know, and Isabella Blow. Wow. You know, they're all of the same kind of ilk, where they just can't see a way out, and it really is so sad to think that is...
It's almost as if they live two... They do actually live two separate lives.
Yeah.
Look at your ex, Robin Williams, for example.
Oh, my God.
These guys, the torment that they're going through.
The torment, as we said...
Did you have any indication that he was a bar, obviously, he was just, addiction...
I knew addiction was going to be...
Anything is a clear sign that something is going wrong.
Well, as you say, the happiest people are sad, as we said before, and I think that can be a really big issue, that you can have these huge plummets of depression. And, you know, you can ask for help, and I think it's, you know, I've had, you know, and a couple of other friends who've passed away from it, and it's tragic to think that you really can't do anything to help them. You really... And you fight yourself and you fight and you think about their families and their parents. Could they have done more? And I'm sure the parents think that too. And but sometimes it's just, I don't know, it will never end up well.
No. And it's funny you say that, because we're talking about, well, you just said that, and yeah, a couple of hours ago you were stood with a knife.
Oh my God. Happen.
Yeah.
I know.
But when you think about that, it's again, it's like two different people. It's
two different
right?
people.
You all stood there thinking, gosh, what would happen here?
Mm.
And that has become normalised, and that became normalised for me too. But, and then it's almost like you talk about it in a completely different light.
Mm.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it's not going to solve itself.
No.
It's we're not going to be healed from it. We just have to live with it.
Within celebrity, how prevalent is mental health issues?
I think it's absolutely huge. And I think there's a, you know, you've got to think about, you know, as we talked about, you know, it's all about body image. It's about physicality. It's about, am I good enough? You constantly, you know, I've got friends who've been in the public eye for years and then they're not. And it's like, how do they react to that? How do they deal with that? It's addiction, because it's like getting your next fix, mm-hmm. you know. So when you do look at a Katie Price or a Kerry Katona of this world, it's that desperation for an extra kind of like fix of fame. It's not necessarily about financial. It's about relevance. It's about
recognition.
Yeah. It's about being out there. It's mm-hmm. about why am I not, you know. Mm. And then there are some brilliant people who navigate fame fantastically, you know. And
how do they do it differently? Or is it just, it's just unique to that person?
I think it's unique to that person. Really? I think, and also just being, I think it's having skills, actually working, you know. I think, I mean, that's someone like Robin Williams was very sad, because he was somebody who was extremely, extremely talented.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you have people who, you know, on paper might not be talented.
No.
So they, you know, and they, but they still, everyone's got the same mental health problems.
Mm. Fascinating. I've got five questions to end, which I
okay.
ask every guest.
Okay, here
comes
we go.
On. And I deliberately didn't tell you them, because okay. I like to get the instant reaction.
Uh-huh.
Number one, what's your favourite book and why?
Oh, my favourite, oh my God.
Easiest in, the easiest one first.
There's a really good book called Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. And he was, I don't know if you know who he is, but he basically was kind of like a weird science fiction writer, and a little bit Scientology, weirdly.
Mm.
Not that I believe in that. I think it's the worst thing ever. That's another podcast.
Yeah.
But he wrote this book called Something Wicked This Way Comes, and Disney made it into a film. It's a massive flop because it's really dark. And it's basically about this circus that comes to this town, and everybody who goes to it has actually previously wished something bad about something else. It's very dark, and it's about expressing their demons. Don't know why I like that one. And I also like The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, which is about adultery.
Yeah.
Don't know why I like that one either.
Yeah.
But I think it's a fantastic book, and it's about actually owning up to your misrepresentation, and in the end, Hester Prynne, who's the one who had the affair, she's walking around with an A for adulterer, which she embroiders and makes it beautiful.
Right.
And that had a really big impact on me, and still does. I think it's a brilliant book.
Yeah, interesting. I can understand why that would have an impact on you. Mm. What lesson have you learnt in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
My mum, before she died, said to me, "To thine own self be true." And I'm actually, if I am true to myself, it always works. Things always work out.
Yeah,
it's when
yeah.
I'm not authentic that it doesn't. Mm. I get a bit, and then when I try and lie about stuff or try and not be authentic, then it doesn't work. Mm. So, yeah.
Okay. Nice. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone, rings you and says he's having a really bad day today. What do you say?
I say, "I'll come over."
Okay.
Or, "Can I help?" Or, "Let's go for a pint and let's talk it through." But I'll definitely be there for that person.
Cool.
Sometimes, though, people don't want you to see them.
No.
I'm that person. You know, if I'm in low, years ago, there'd be situations where I wouldn't want people to see me.
It's kind of the burden thing. Right?
Yeah. But at least you can have a chat with them over the phone, which is great.
Okay. When you're struggling with something, what's your go-to? Like, who do you turn to improve things?
I turn to my husband, obviously, and then I turn to. I used to turn to my dad, and I think I turn to my brother. Like, my brother and I are close, but we're not that close. But I like him, and he loves me, and he's very practical, so he kind of tells it as it is.
Right.
And in a weird way, he's not part of my circle, although he's my brother. Mm. So it means that if I do dip into some kind of low depression, he won't tell anyone. No one's going to know. So yeah, I kind of feel a bit safe there.
Interesting. Last one. You're lying on your deathbed, looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
Oh my God, that's really hard. What am I most proud of?
Pay me the big bucks for.
Well, I'm proud of being married.
Really?
I'm proud of getting to the stage where I asked somebody who I was in love with to get married to me. And I love my life with him. So I think that's the most proud moment I could ever wish to have.
That is wonderful. Very interesting. I had somebody else the other week who was gay, again, similar type of reaction to you actually in coming out. He was like, so what? And he said that he was most proud of being honest.
Mm. Mm.
And I was actually like, in terms of the relevance to his journey,
yeah,
that's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fabulous answer. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, being married is...
Yeah, well, that is.
That is. That's lovely.
It's like an achievement.
Yeah.
I think. No, I know.
Yeah.
3 years in, I'm like, fuck.
Oh, my God.
Mitch, it's 33.
Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Yeah, actually, a free therapy session.
Yeah, well, a lot of people say that. I don't know what to make of that, but maybe it's a career coming.
Yeah, maybe it is. We need to get you
a
Just Giving page.
Yes. Yeah, no, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an amazing... We've done an hour and 10 minutes.
Have we?
Yeah.
Wow.
Incredible. So thank you for being so open.
Yay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Nick's openness and willingness to explore so many aspects of his childhood, his teenage years, how he dealt with his mother's death are genuinely so inspiring, I think. It's fascinating also to listen to his take on imposter syndrome, which he suffers with quite badly. And I know a lot of people who listen to this podcast and people that I've spoken to through the podcast also suffer with imposter syndrome. Here is somebody who runs a successful business, knows everyone and anyone in the celebrity world, is recognised on TV and really, really well respected, yet he doesn't quite recognise it himself yet. So to explore how that came about and how he deals with that, I think, is fascinating and amazing. I know Nick felt like this episode was a bit of a therapy session for him because he got loads off his chest, which is lovely to hear and probably pretty important. Like, for me, he will inspire so many people to open up in his circles, which is just extraordinary. So thank you, Nick Ead, for coming on the podcast. Next week on The Rut, I sit down with former Manchester United winger Luke Chadwick to talk about winning the treble in 1999, being there at the Nou Camp, training with that infamous United team as they won so many things. His long battle with his mental health whilst playing, after he received a lot of abuse on TV, and how he overcame depression when he retired to become the happiest he's ever been. I literally cannot wait for you to listen to this episode. It's absolutely fantastic. Please do remember to leave us a review. You can literally tap the subscribe button if this is the first time you're listening to the podcast. Your reviews, your feedback, your comments, your posts on social media, your tweets, whatever it might be, we receive them, we retweet them, we share them, but also it kind of shows that the message is being widely received that we're putting out, and it supports our guests, and it's just lovely, really lovely to see the subscribers go up. and the reviews to come in continually. So thank you so much to everybody who's done that so far. If you haven't, please do remember to subscribe. Click the subscribe button after this. And yeah, we will see you next week. Thank you.